But I would have to say that a Chabad Rebbe, when we were going through Tzuris, family, health Tzuris with one of my children, and I was not really involved with Judaism at that time, but I ran to him in desperation, and he said to me, "This too shall be good, I promise." And that one statement, "This shall be good, I promise," changed my life. And it brought me into practicing Judaism today. Anybody else?
So some of you had a little trouble thinking of finding that person. Well, this is what happened to me. I was Sukkot, and I was in Chicago. And I was in Chicago, I was staying by my daughter, and we went to a neighbor for a seudah, for, you know, a meal in the Sukkot. And it was a very nice, beautiful day. But the host got up and said, "I have a question for everybody." And the question was the question I asked you. But he asked us, "Who is the most important person in your life besides your family?" And he went around the table asking. And just like here, one or two people hemmed and hawed, and they thought about it, and they found somebody. A lot of people didn't answer. When it came to me, it didn't even take me 5 seconds. I right away said, "Revson Jethman Kaplan," because she was the most important person and the greatest person in my life, was Revson Jethman Kaplan. Well, that was the first thing that happened years ago, about 7 years ago. Then the next thing was a few weeks later, I was in Miami at a bar mitzvah. And I was sitting around, again, in a seudah. I like to eat, you know. So we're sitting around, and people are introducing themselves. And I turn to my right, and I tell her, "I'm Danielle Leibowitz. What's your name?" And she says, "My name is Rivka Kaplan." And we choose. She's from Brooklyn. I'm from Queens. And then she says to me, I said, "Are you by any chance related to Riverson Kaplan?" She said, "Yes, I'm very related to her." I said, "Really? How?" She said, "I'm her first daughter-in-law. I married her eldest son. So I was her first daughter-in-law." So I said, "Wow, that must have been marvelous. You were her daughter-in-law, you know, Riverson Kaplan." She says, "No, I'll tell you the truth. I had no idea who my mother-in-law was. All I know is she was on the phone all the time, and she was always busy and running to the school that she was working at. And I didn't pay her much attention. I wasn't respectful to her. You know, she was my mother-in-law." And she said, "But now I regret it so much that I didn't appreciate her, and I didn't want to know what a marvelous, wonderful person, and how she started every single Beis Yaakov, every Jewish school in America. It was really bad." So I said, "John, you know, you're right." I said, "Nobody ever recognized her. Nobody ever gave her any due that was owed to her. Nobody. They just took it for granted." And I thought to myself, and I went home. And then my children, my husband, the Rosh Hashiva, had just died. It was 2008. And my children said, "Ma," you know how children are, they tell you what to do, you know, they run your life. They said, "You can't stay at home. You got to get a job." I said, "A job?" I said, "Come on, I'm too old." I said, "What do you think? I'm going to mop the floors, I'm going to do the windows, forget it." And I said, "And education, you know, I had enough of it. I'm too old for that. I don't think I want to do that." And they said, "Yeah, but you got to do something, and you can't stay home." So that's when I started my, I would say, obsession, passion is a good word. It was my passion. I was going to do a biography of my Revitson, and I was going to have my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, know who my Revitson was. You know, nobody talked about her, nobody knew her name, and it wasn't fair. So I started. That was going to be my goal for the next year or so, and I knew I had a plan. I was going to go to the family, interview everybody in the family, and there were 12 children. Two had passed away when I started. And I was going to interview all my classmates who I could find, and whoever had gone to Beis Yaakov, who had ever gone to the school, and who had been part of Revis and Kaplan's life. Okay, that was my plan, and I implemented it. I bought myself a microphone, a little microphone like that, put it in my pocket. When I saw it, everybody said, "Oh, you were Revis and Kaplan's part? Tell me something." And I gathered a lot of information. Then I went to the family, and I said to them, "You know, nobody ever wrote about your mother, and would you mind if I wrote a biography, or I got somebody to write a biography?" They said, "No, we would most appreciate it. We really think it would be marvelous if we get a biography of her." So I interviewed the family, and I interviewed everybody and a lot of things. Then I was ready to get the book together. But I wasn't quite ready to write, so I went to a few famous people who were writers. The first one I went to was Mrs. Glickman, and she told me, "Oh, I think that's a great story. I'd love to do it, but I'm in doing 3 books. I can't do it." The second person I went to was Rabbi Yisrael Besser. He's my favorite author, but he's in Mishpacha. He writes a weekly magazine. He's one of the editors. Plus, he does a lot of biographies. And he said, "That's a marvelous idea. You really should do it, but I have no time." Then the third person I went to was a lady who was in a wheelchair. I thought, "Oh, this is it. She's in a wheelchair. She'll have plenty of time to write my book." And she said to me, I had already done, you know, a little sample of what I wanted. And she read it and she said, "Oh, that's really nice. I really think it's a great idea. But I'm writing my memoirs. So when I finish my memoirs, maybe I'll have time." So I was really kind of disappointed, and I said, "What's going to be now?" So I called up Rabbi Krohn. You ever hear Rabbi Pesach Krohn? Yeah, he was a friend of my late husband. So I said, "Rabbi Krohn, I have this marvelous idea. I want to write a biography of Revison Bethany Kaplan, who was the one who initiated every single girls' school in America and Canada." I said, "And nobody wants to do it. So what should I do?" So Rabbi Krohn, very practical guy, he said, "Well, why don't you sit down and write it?" I said, "Me?" He said, "Yeah." So I listened to him, I sat down, and I wrote it. And now I'll begin the book. But before I begin the book, I think I should give you a little background of what America and what New York was like when I came to America and when Revison Kaplan came to America. That was the 30s, way before any of you were even born or even anything. And I want to talk about what America was like when Revison Kaplan came to start her school for Jewish girls. There were none whatsoever. Except maybe a little bit after school, 1 or 2 classes, Sunday school, but nothing to talk about. So the first thing I want to talk about is what was the Jewish scene in America, in New York. I was in New York, I don't know about the rest of the country, but New York. The first thing I want to tell you is kashrus. How to eat kosher. So when I was a little girl, you had to go to a special butcher, and there weren't too many, you had to go to the butcher. You had to get your meat. Sometimes you had to kosher your own meat and your chicken. It wasn't so easy. It didn't come in those nice meat packages. It was not so easy. But I didn't care about the meat and the food. I was a little girl, so I was caring about the nash. So let me tell you about the nash. It was candy corn, and it were cookies, and what else did we have? Not as variety as we have today, but Yankee Doodles, and what else did we have? You know, all those things. And I couldn't eat them because my parents told me that, you know, we're kosher, we don't eat treif. So what, how do you keep kosher? When I was a little girl, two things I had to know. One, I had to know that glycerin was made from animal bone. And the second one is there were two kind of shortenings. Either it was vegetable shortening or plain shortening. And I had the instructions. When you go to buy candy in the candy store, you look at the ingredients. If the ingredient says gelatin, no good. If the ice cream is made out of gelatin, no good. And the candy corn that I really, really loved was made out of gelatin. But there were plenty of things I could eat, and any cookie or cake that said shortening, I didn't eat, but if it said vegetable shortening, I had it. So that's the way we knew about kashrus. There were no OU, no OK, no CKC, nothing like that. In the 30s, in the 40s, there were no kosher, there was kosher, we ate kosher, but only with those ingredients. A Shabbos. What was Shabbos like when I was a little girl? When I was a little girl, my friends went to the matinee on Shabbos. It was a movie, a matinee, it was special. It was special cartoons, nice movies. It was a hot day, we went there, it was air conditioned. So that was what we did on Shabbos. Or you could go shopping. Sunday, there was a blue lord. Sunday stores were not open in the 40s. School was not closed on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur like we have today. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur were regular school days. And Pesach was a little easier because it usually coincided with Easter, but otherwise. And then something personal. My first father-in-law, David B. Cohen, he was born in America. He was a CPA and he had a job. But every Friday when he told the boss, I'm not coming in tomorrow, the boss said, oh, is that so? Well, I don't want to see you because Saturday is the most important day in this accounting firm. And if you're not here, forget it. And he would lose his job. He eventually got a job in Monet, and the boss was Jewish, and he said, fine, you can take off Saturday. That's what it was like on Shabbos. The next thing is the synagogue. What kind of synagogues were there in the 30s and 40s? Nothing like you have today. They had the shtiglach with, you know, very small minyan with the Rebbe. There weren't many of them because there weren't many Hasidim in America. They only came in the after World War II, the Hasidim. So there were very, very few, maybe one or two. And the shuls were old buildings, nothing modern, gorgeous like we have today, old buildings. And most of them had mixed seating. The Orthodox, which were very few and far between, did have men on one side, women on the other side, but very little. But the big thing was Hazanim in those days. In the 30s and 40s, they were cantors, Hazanim, who used to sing. But they would sing in the synagogue, right? And Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur was a big drawing card. The chazan would come in, you know, and very famous chazan, and they would sell tickets to go in. Now, came Rosh Hashanah, you had to buy a ticket, and you could not get into that synagogue unless you had your ticket. And, but what if you didn't have a ticket? So they wouldn't let you in. But they were smart, they sold the tickets on Rosh Hashanah and on Yom Kippur. But again, my father-in-law, David B. Cohn, he wouldn't allow it. He used to make a big fuss. I don't know, I wasn't married yet. He used to make a big fuss, and he wouldn't let them sell the tickets. One more thing that you won't believe, that the young Israel and the synagogues that were supposedly Orthodox had dances. Every Saturday night, you could go to dance, and you could dance with, you know, whoever you wanted. It was an accepted thing. It took many years later to straighten it out, and there were no more mixed dancing. And the last thing I want to tell you about is modesty. What was the world like? Well, the secular world was pretty conservative and pretty nice. People dressed very nicely, you know. So that wasn't such a big issue in those days because people didn't dress. People, the only ones who wore low cuts and high slits and, you know, seductive clothes, and those were low class, you know, people in general did. One more thing is that it was so conservative that if you went to Coney Island and you were on the beach in the sand, you could wear your bathing suit. But the minute you got up on the boardwalk, you got to get dressed. And if you weren't dressed, you, am I right? They would give you a summons and you had to pay because you were in decent exposure. You had to be dressed on the boardwalk. Don't go to the boardwalk. Don't go to the boardwalk now. Okay, so now I'll go back to Remsen Kaplan. How did she start? Where did she come from? I had no idea. I just knew she was my Remsen and she was the most important person in my life. She had changed my life. I idolized her. But how did she start? You know, where was she born? Where did she come from? I had no idea. She came from Europe, that's all I knew. Well, I did research, and I'll give you a synopsis very quickly, very briefly. She was born in a very small town called Flodden. And she came from a very nice family. Her father had been Rabbi Lubchansky, and her brother was also a rabbi. And she was a little girl, and she had a very nice father and mother. And for 5 years, she was a happy little girl, just like all little girls, had a very nice home, until she was five. When she was 5 years old, there was an epidemic. I think it was a typhoid. Nobody really ascertained what it was, but there was an epidemic, and she died. And that was when she was five. By the time she was 11, her father died. So
you said she died at five. You mean her mother?
She was 5 years old when her mother died.
Okay.
And I said, what?
You said she died, so I...
I know, I meant
the mother. Okay.
The mother died, and the little girl was left, and her father was there. He was very sickly already. By 11 years old, she had no one. So Rabbi Lubchansky had no children. He was... And he was in a yeshiva called Baranovich, which is for young boys. It wasn't like a big yeshiva for, you know, adult boys. It was for young boys from 12 to about 17 before they go to the yeshiva. That was the yeshiva that Rabbi Lubchansky was. And in this yeshiva, there was a very big rabbi. One of the great rabbis of the century was Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman. Have you ever heard of him? He was very big, and Rabbi Wasserman was very close to the Chofetz Chaim in Rodin in Poland, so he was really big. But anyhow, Vesna and her little brother were living in the yeshiva with their aunt and uncle, and they grew up, and they were living in Baranovich. And then, when she was doing pretty well, helping her mother, her aunt, and then when she was 16, she saw an ad in the paper. And the ad in the paper changed her life. The ad was, they're opening up a new seminary in Krakow, and they were going to have teachers, seminary was going to make teachers, they're going to give them teacher diplomas, and they were going to go out and be teachers all over Poland. Because at that time, there were no Jewish schools for girls. Lots of boys, but even the girls. So this lady, Sara Schneerer, maybe you've heard of her. Sara Schneerer was marvelous, and she decided that she's going to open up this seminary, and she's going to have the girls learn, you know, get Jewish. And she got teachers from Germany, from Frankfurt. She got all these teachers who had been very well educated. She had them come to be teachers there. And then... Vesna decides she wants to go there. Well, easier said than done, because she sends her application, and on her application, she gets it refused. You can't come. Well, Vesna, her last name was Eisen, her maiden name, which means iron. She said, no way, I am going to go. There's nobody's going to stop me. So she decides she's going to go. So even though she got a refusal, because why did she get refused? Because she didn't have enough credentials. She hadn't gone to a public high school. She had gone to a Jewish school. She needed more courses. And so she took them. There was no problem. She was a smart little girl. She read well. So she got them. She sent her application back again the second time, and this time they accepted her. So she goes to her uncle and says, Rabbi Lipchansky, I'm going to Krakow, and I'm going to become a teacher. And Rabbi Lipchansky says, what do you mean? You're going to Krakow? You know what Krakow is? It's a terrible city. They have all kinds of awful people. It's a big city. It's like Las Vegas today. Like if I tell little kids about Las Vegas. This was Krakow, the capital of Poland at the time. And he said, no way, I won't let you go. A nice Jewish girl like you does not belong in a terrible city like that. Well, that made her quite unhappy. And Rabbi Wasserman sees her and says, what's her problem? So she said, well, I'm having a problem with my uncle. He won't let me go to Krakow. He said, why do you want to go to Krakow? And she tells him about the seminary, and he says, you're right, you should go. I'm sure you should go, and I really applaud you, and I'm so glad you're going, and I'm going to speak to you, to your uncle. And she, once Rabbi Hanna Wasserman said yes, there was nothing Rabbi Lipchansky could do. So she was ready to go. We're not finished. Okay, she's accepted, but it's a very fancy seminary. I saw it. It's a really beautiful seminary. It's 4 stories high. It's stone. It's gorgeous. And how did she get all the money? Well, I'll explain to you how Sarah Schneer got all this money to build this gorgeous place. She was a very determined lady. She went to the parliament, the Polish parliament, and told them about the school. She went to the Hasidim. She was Hasidic. She went to the Bells of Rebbe, and she told them all about how she's gotten to educate the girls. The boys won't be able to, you know, the girls are out in the streets. They don't know anything about Yiddishkeit, and they won't marry the Jewish boys. They're all going off the derech, off the way. So he said, see, we need it. And she went to the Gera Rebbe, was also a big Rebbe. And the last thing was the Aguda. There was a committee of yeshivas where they were collecting money to open up schools, and they got her money. So with all that money, she built this beautiful. But she charged a lot of tuition. And what do you think Bethna had? Nothing. They were poor, very, very poor. But that didn't stop Rabbi Wasserman. Wasserman said, you know what? I have a very good friend, Dr. Deutschlander, who's he teaches in that school. I'll write to him. And he wrote to him. He said, a wonderful girl. I want to send her there. And, you know, we have no funds. So actually, Rabbi Wasserman didn't have money. And his yeshiva didn't have money. And Rabbi Wasserman used to be in New York. He used to come to America to collect money for his yeshiva. But that's another story. I won't go into it. So then, that is my phone. That is finally working. It's not going to work. It's just turned off. I was just saying that it definitely goes straight to... Maybe they fixed it. Anyhow.
I think it's her watching.
And so Rabbi Deutschlander writes back. He said, Dear Rabbi Wasserman, I know exactly the situation, because when I was young, I was an orphan. I had no money, and people helped me. She can go on the expulsion. So Vefna goes to Krakow and graduates. She stays there, I think it's 2 years, and she graduates. But not only does she graduate, but she's a valedictorian. She's the absolute best student in the school. I'll give you just one example of how good she was. On Shabbos, the girls didn't take notes. So when the teachers gave lectures, they couldn't take notes. But Vefna was so great that after Shabbos, the girls would come over to Vefna and say, could you repeat what Dr. Deutschlander said? And she could repeat it, and they would write it. So anyhow, so here she is, the best, the most marvelous student, and she has to go out to get a job. Do you know where she gets a job? She gets a job in Brisk. Now, you don't know what Brisk is, but if you know what Harvard is in America, well, Brisk is the Harvard of Poland. Everybody knows Brisk, that's where the Soloveitchiks are. You know, Rabbi Soloveitchik, he had the most illustrious yeshiva there, and he calls up, he doesn't call up, I keep picking my phone, it's a cell phone. He writes to Sarah Schneer and says, I need a teacher for my daughters. And Sarah Schneer doesn't hesitate, says, I have a girl, and she sends Bethna to Brisk. And somebody told me, when I was interviewing people, somebody told me she knows that her father said, when they lived in Brisk, and there was a sign on the in the synagogue that said that Bethna is going to give a speech. Everybody in the town would come, even the men. They would all come to listen to her. She was so dynamic. Well, so she's a marvelous teacher there, and she teaches Rabbi Soloveitchik's daughters, but she's getting a little old. She's in her 20s already, and she needs a shidduch. So she needs a shidduch, and a matchmaker comes along and meets her and says, wow, she is a super wonderful person. This girl needs a wonderful husband. So the matchmaker goes to the yeshiva and says, who's the best boy in the yeshiva? And best boy in yeshiva was Baruch Kaplan. And who is Baruch Kaplan? He's a young man from the east side. He's from New York, from the east side, and he went to Poland, and he was learning in Brisk, and the match was made. They met each other, they liked each other, everything was fine, until it was the 1930s, late 30s, and Hitler became the chancellor. The Nazis were taking over Germany, and they were starting to make plans, a lot of anti-Semitism, and the parents, Baruch Kaplan's parents, said, no, what's going on here? We want our son to come back. And then the father wasn't doing so well. Baruch Kaplan's father was a little bit sick, so had a great excuse. They told them, come back. So Baruch Kaplan goes back to New York, back to the east side, and Bethna stays in Brisk. And they're still corresponding. And Bethna gets the children told me this story. And Bethna's getting a little impatient. What's going on with Baruch, you know? So she writes to him, well, are we getting married? Are we not, you know? And when he gets this letter, the kids told me that he sent a telegram. And he wrote on it, Mazel Tov. He gave her the answer. And he sent money for her to come to America. And she comes on the Queen Mary with a lot of important people. But so now she's coming to America. She does not speak English, and she does not speak a word of English. But when she gets into, when she comes to New York, a few weeks after she's in America, she gets married to Baruch Kaplan. He already is a rabbi in the boys' school. He has a position. What else does she do? She's trying to learn English a little bit, and she's trying to get, you know, settled, and they move to Williamsburg. That's where they live, Williamsburg. Brooklyn is a small community in Williamsburg, with a lot of religious people. And the first thing she does is she says, now that I'm in America, I've got to start my Beis Yaakov here. I had it in Brisk, but it needs to be here. Well, you think that was an easy thing? No way. She needs students. So she goes around, looking around, knocking at doors and telling people who have daughters, you know, I'd like your daughter to come to my school. That's what it means. We want our daughter to be a rabbi. She's a girl. You know, boys have to go to learn Hebrew. They have to learn to read a Siddur. But girls, they don't need that. Well, anyhow, she is getting very discouraged because they want all the girls to be secretaries and, you know, stenography and typing, get good jobs, doctors, lawyers. This is America. You know, we can. Our girls can get a wonderful education, and it was free. You know, I didn't pay in the city university. I was paying. Yes, you did pay registration, but that was it. So nobody wants to come. the girls who came from very Orthodox homes, the mothers said, what do you mean? Girls should go to school? We know how to educate our girls. We know exactly what to do, so the girls will stay home and they'll learn their Jewish education they'll get from us. We'll teach them what kosher is. We'll teach them how to bake challah and shalit, all that. That's enough. We don't start up with us. So she was very discouraged, and she went to a Rabbi Mendelowitz, a Shorter Mendelowitz, and he was the head of the boys' yeshiva. There were a lot of boys' yeshiva, the East Side, Williamsburg, and there weren't, there was no lack of yeshivas at that time, because I don't think there was a lack, but there were enough boys' schools. And she went to Rabbi Mendelowitz and said, how did you start your school? I can't get any students, I don't know what to do. So Rabbi Mendelowitz said, you know what, Reverend Kaplan, I can't help you. I have no money, I have no building, I can't help you. But I have two daughters. I'll give you my two daughters. So his two daughters went to school. And then there was another family called Pilcher. And the Pilcher girls, they went to the school. The parents sent them, and they went. And then there were three more friends. So altogether, there were seven girls, just seven. And luckily, I got all seven of them to interview. And I asked them what was it like. Reverend Kaplan had a table, and these girls would come every single night at 7 o'clock to Reverend Kaplan and sit around her table, and even on Sunday, and they would come, and even on Shabbos she would have Shabbos groups where they would come and just have a good time together, and they did this for an entire year, and I have to explain to you who those girls are. They were ordinary girls. They were American girls. They went to public school, Eastern District. They all went to public school from 9 to 3. And at 3 o'clock, they went for a job. Because remember, I'm telling you, these are the 30s, when it was right after the Depression. Parents didn't have enough money to run the household. So the girls would get jobs and give the money to their parents. There was no question that you helped with the household. So the Pilcher girls would work in their father's, from 3 to 6, they would work in their father's store and sell material. He had a material store, remember? And then one of the girls was teaching. She taught a little Talmud Torah from 4 to 5. She was in a Talmud Torah. I can't explain Talmud Torah. It's like it's after school. Hebrew school at the word. Yeah, a little Hebrew school. So all the girls worked. From 9 o'clock in the morning, they were busy all day, from 9 to 6, and they came every single day. And that was the beginning. Those seven girls that I interviewed, I don't want to give you details, but they weren't too happy when they first started. But they loved her, and they never left her. And then they continued the following year, a lot more friends. And this school, from these little seven girls, is growing to thousands. Thousands. Thousands of girls. Every single Jewish school started around that table. And by 1944, there were so many girls that Rabbi Kaplan, it's a very strange story, he went and borrowed money from one of his friends, the London Brothers, borrowed money from the London Brothers. The London Brothers, they bought a building on South 8th Street. An old junky building. I don't know what it was before that, in the school I went to. And they bought the school, and now they're going to have a full day. So in other words, Beis Yaakov is now not around the kitchen table, but by 1944, it was a complete day school. The girls went for Jewish subjects in the morning and the afternoon. They had all the secular subjects. And there were two streets. One was commercial, so the girls could learn typing and geography. The other one was academic for the girls who wanted to go on to college. So that's what it was. Now, I want to go straight to tell you who Reverend Kaplan was. I don't want to explain it to you. Her actions is what made her. And I'm going to share with you the interviews I had, the stories the girls gave me. And that will explain to you how, why, and how Reverend Kaplan is this great person. First story I want to tell you is there was going to be a faculty meeting. So Revison Kaplan told two girls, you know, you two, you go out and do me a favor. I want to have, this is a very important meeting, and I want to set a beautiful table, and I want it to really impress the teachers, and we're going to have a really nice meeting. It's going to be a long meeting. So I want you to go and buy the nicest tablecloth and matching plates and matching cups, you know, really get the nicest you can find, get it, buy it. And then I want you to buy some fruits, buy cantaloupe, grapes, and melon, and strawberry, and whatever. And then go to the bakery and get some nice cookies and platters. And then I want you to set it in the faculty room and let me know when you're done. And the girls were ecstatic. Wow, I don't have to go to school. I can cut a class. They went out. They bought more beautiful dishes and tablecloths. And it was beautiful. And they set it up. And then they cut the melons, the cantaloupe. They cut the cantaloupe. And it was going to be very fancy. They put strawberries on the cantaloupe. And the cookies, everything was just so. And they were, wow, and they were proud of themselves. Whoop, this really looks great. So Reverend Kaplan comes in, and she's very impressed. She says, oh, girls, you did a beautiful job. But the girls are like, what did they do wrong? She says, but you don't know, but there's a halacha. There's a law in the Torah that says we don't eat bugs. And those strawberries, there are bugs on them. We have to wash them and check them. So the girls were ready to take the strawberries and throw them out. And but she says, no, leave them there. You did such a beautiful job. I want you to leave it there. And when the teachers come in, they'll be so impressed. And I'll explain to them that the strawberries are just for decoration. They can eat them. That was the first story I want to tell you about my lesson. Second one is a story of a friend of mine. Her name is Abigail Finer. Now, Abigail had just transferred from a more modern school, a Zionist school, and she wore short socks, short sleeves. She wasn't quite, you know, she had just come into the school the year before, and she was still wearing not exactly what the most religious building. She wore socks and short sleeves. And they had a production. The production was the story of Sarah Schneera. So, big production, all the girls were in it. And the role of Sarah Schneera was given to Abigail Finer. And the teachers were having a heart attack. They said, how could we let this girl, you know, this Shipstein, this girl who's, you know, not really religious, you know, she's going to portray Sarah Schneera. That's terrible. Sacrilege. And Gregson Kaplan hears this and she says, you're wrong. Abigail Finer, that's her role. And she's a wonderful girl. And she deserves that role and she's going to take it. And I know that she's a wonderful girl and don't worry about it. She gets that role. And while this was going on, one of her friends was out in the hall and heard this conversation with Revson Kaplan and the teacher who was talking to her, and she went back and told Abigail. Now, once Abigail heard that, she said, you know what? Revson Kaplan believes in me, and she gave me that role, and she's my protector. I'm going to live up to it. And let me tell you about Abigail Finer. Abigail Finer grew up to be a wonderful person. Not only was she a wonderful person, she moved to Israel, and she got married to Rabbi Rabbits. And you know who Rabbi Rabbits was? He was a minister in the Knesset in Eretz Yisrael. He was a wonderful person. So that was the role of Sarah Schneera. The third one you're going to like. This is a story about four girls who are coming to school on a Friday morning, the end of the week. It's been a long week. And they have to go and sit in class. They don't want to do that. And the girls decide, Bracha, Deborah, Sarah, and Rachel. They said, we don't want to go to class. And Bracha said, you know what? I have nothing to wear for Shabbos. Not a thing. There's nothing I can wear. The dress I have is just It's a schmatz, it's a rag, I can't wear it. No good. I think I need a new dress. And then Devorah said, you know what? I gained so much weight, it's so tight, I can't wear my Shabbos ring. I gotta go. The third one said, you know, you're right, I also have nothing to wear. I got a stain on my dress last week, and my mother couldn't get it out, it's still stained. And then Rachel said, hey, wait a minute. You know what? I saw it in the paper that said that Macy's having a 50% off. So I said, well, that's it. That's Hashgacha. It must be. We got to get to Macy's. So the girls went on the subway, and they said, yeah, but what about Rabbi Miller's class? You know, period, fourth period. We can't cut Rabbi Miller's class. You know, that's an important class. So they said, no problem. We'll take the subway. We'll buy our stuff, and we'll come right back. And that's what they did. They took the subway. They got to Macy's. Oh, they got bargains. Every single girl got a beautiful dress or top or whatever she wanted. And they got it in a shopping bag, a red shopping bag from Macy's with the logo, RH Macy's. And come home with each one had the same shopping bag, their own shopping bag. And they're back on time. And they're going down the street when lo and behold, Robinson Kaplan is walking. And Robinson Kaplan looks at the girls and says, She doesn't say a word. She says, you know what, girls? I want your mother to call me. Have your mother call me. Well, the girls, they were flabbergasted. What are they going to do? They're telling their mother they went shopping and they went to Macy's and they got stuff and they weren't in class. My mother's going to kill me, my father. I can't do that. I can't tell my mother. Well, being intelligent girls, they had a solution. You know what the solution was? Well, Rachel said, my mother speaks with a very thick accent, a thick Polish accent. I'm going to imitate her. And the other one, Sarah says, my mother only talks Yiddish. So I'll talk Yiddish. I'll call up the Remsen and say, I'm Mrs. Katz. And she called me to call, so I call him. And the girl also said, don't worry, I'll call. And each one of the girls gets on the phone. The first girl gets on the phone. And she said, hello, this is Mrs. Goldberg. My daughter told me I should speak to the Remsen. And this is Devorah's mother. And the Rebbe says, oh, thank you so much for calling, but I have another phone call over there. Could you call me back in 10 minutes? The second girl who speaks in Yiddish, the Rebbe says, yes, I did tell you to call, but I just can't talk to you right now because somebody walks in. Please call me back. And the third and fourth, well, the girls were petrified that they didn't know what was going to happen. The Rebbe was going to call and tell their mother all the shenanigans. You know what? Rebbe Kaplan never called these girls, his parents. And those girls never again went shopping. That was her business. Oh, here's one that you're going to like. There was a problem with Shengel. What was the problem with Shengel? Well, Shengel will come to school with tight sweaters, very tight sweaters. And the teachers did not like it. It was not fitting for a nice Jewish girl to wear tight sweaters. But every day, tight sweaters. And her friends started wearing tight sweaters too. They thought, oh, this is a nice thing to do. And the teachers said, we gotta suspend this Shengel. She's a terrible influence. You gotta get rid of her. And they had a teacher's meeting at the faculty meeting. They're talking about Shengel. Shengel is ruining the school. So Reverend Kaplan said, oh, wait a minute, I'll speak to her. And Shengel's an excellent student. She's, you know, one of the leading students, you know, academically, socially. She's, you know, like the queen of the class. And Reverend Kaplan calls her into the office and says, Shengel, the teachers speak very, very well of you. And they think that you're doing very well, and you know, she tells her all the nice things about it. And then she says to her, I want to ask you a question. She says, yeah, what? She says, who goes shopping when you buy clothes? It's my mother. Oh yeah, she says, and who picks out the clothes? Well, sometimes I do, and sometimes my mother does. But we have the same taste. We always agree. We very rarely do we don't agree. And we buy the clothes, and that's it. So, Reverend Penn said, well, that's very nice. You keep it up. You really honor your mother. Wonderful. And she's about ready to go out. And then she says, wait a minute, Chandel, I want to ask you a favor. So Chandel turns around. Yeah, what can I do? She says, you know, next time you go shopping, buy one size bigger. And Chandel got the message. And Chandel wore dress sweaters that were one size bigger. Solved the problem. Here's another girl, Tova. Tova is another one of my friends who's always cutting class. Always cutting class. Every day she cuts one class. And the teacher said, what kind of student is this? Got to get rid of Tova, you know, like there's no help. We keep talking about it, tell her she can't do it, but she doesn't listen. Always kind of play. So, Gretchen Kaplan has her come down to the office, and Tova, she said, Tova, and Tova knows exactly why she's in the office, because she's been playing hooky so much. And the Gretchen says to her, Tova, tell me something. Why do you cut so many classes? She says, well, I just feel like cutting that class. She says, okay. So what do you do when you cut the class? So Toby says, I play my guitar. And I just feel like I gotta play my guitar. So Reverend Kaplan says to her, you know what? When I was 16, I used to like to dance and sing, and I understand you very, very well. So when you want to play a guitar, Tova, and you want to cut a class, so do me one favor. She says, yeah, what can I do? She says, come in and ask my permission, and then I'll let you go. So Tova told me she never asked her permission, and she never cut a class. Here's one. Here's one more, I think. Two more. Cheating. The girls had a big test. An IFRS test. Reverend Kaplan had 100 words on this test. And she told them 3 weeks that the test was going to be on Monday. So Sunday night, they all get together in Russell's house, and they start studying. And they said, 100 words? Impossible. We can't do it. Of course, they had a crib one night to get the 100 words. And this was going to be impossible. But my friends and my Basiaco girls were very clever, and they said, wait. We have a great idea. You know what? You learn the first 25 words of the list, and you know the translation, they know the translation, you know the spelling, but 25 words you know perfectly. And you learn the next 25 words, 25, but you've got to know them. And you do the third 25 words, and you over there will do the last 25 words. And they sat there, and each one studied 25 words, and they knew them perfect. And they said, but remember, tomorrow we got to sit close to each other. So that in the morning, they come to class, and they sit very close to each other. And this is a true story. And they sit very close together, and they have 100 words. And guess what? They got 100 words right. Every single word was right. They were very cooperative, and they managed to get 100 words right. And they walked out of class, they said, well, weren't we marvelous? We got 100 words right, and this is easy going. Well, the next morning, they come back to class, and Reverend Kaplan has marked their papers, and each girl gets their paper back. And on Shani's paper, it says 100/4. Which means it was 100 divided by 4, which is actually not. The second girl got 100/4. That was the end of their cheating career. She never said a word to them, but they got the mark and they got the message. I'll end with one last one, which was, I think, very nice, which is one of the reasons why my Robertson was so marvelous, and you understand the story. Reverend Kaplan is teaching a seminary class. seminary means the girls were 17, or you were 18, yeah, 17, 18, 19, you know, they had graduated high school, and she was teaching a class, and she's in front of the room teaching a class, and Mr. Cohen walks in, and Mr. Cohen comes over to Reverend Kaplan and puts his hand out, and Reverend Kaplan shakes it, and the girls are all, which is sore, Reverend Kaplan shaking hands, they're all thinking, what's happening? And Mr. Collins walks the rest in Kaplan, and he leaves. And then she turns around to the girls and says to the girls, we know there's a halacha, we know there's a law in the Talmud, in the Torah, that says you don't shake hands with men. You know, women, it's not, we don't do that. That's, men don't shake hands with women, women don't shake hands with men. But when Mr. Collins came in, and he put out his hand, and if I hadn't shaken his hand, he would have been embarrassed. He would have been mortified if I took away my hand. And it's worse to insult somebody and embarrass him. So I had to shake his hand. Which doesn't mean that you should, but sometimes you have to be a match. And that's a story I thought was really special. I'd like to end with a book, a quote from a book. I had written this story, I had written the whole book, and all the stories were in it, and it's, you know, pretty much finished, when I noticed a book by Rabbi Noach Ulrich. I know he's a very famous writer, and his name, the name of the book was My Disciple, My Child. And in it, there was a chapter that said problem children. And in the problem children, it was something about Reverend Kaplan, you know, problem children. So I got the book, so here's the book. About 30 years ago, at the conclusion of a tea in Muncie, a tea where you raise money, it was a fundraising tea, and Reverend Kaplan was there. It was too late to find public transportation back to Brooklyn. She had come from Brooklyn to Muncie. One woman happily volunteered to take Reverend Kaplan all the way back to Brooklyn and make the long drive back again to Muncie. And this was like late at night already, it was 11:30. And later, Reverend Mashinsky, who was her daughter-in-law, Maha Tanster, asked the lady why she had been so eager to volunteer. After all, it was going back and forth. The woman explained, when I was in eighth grade, I told my mother that all my classmates, everybody, would be going and attending Ramaz High School. My mother answered that we could not afford the tuition for that school. And she had a much better school for me to attend, and she told me it was Beis Yaakov. I was very unexcited, to say the least. From that day, from day one, from the very first day, I gave the teachers a really hard time. They would often send me down to Reverend Kaplan's office, like 3 or 4 times a week, and for good reason. Rather than lecture or punish me, Reverend Kaplan would just sit me down and tell me what a smart and what a wonderful Jewish girl I was. And this happened consistently for a few months, until I began to believe it. And maybe she's right. And then I changed. Those kind and thoughtful words changed my life, the woman paused. So if Reverend Kaplan needs a ride home, it is my greatest pleasure and privilege to be at her service. I read that story in the book. I read it once, I read it twice. And I got the unbelievable feeling I knew that story, but you see, the story was about me. And I was a woman who had given Remsen Kaplan the ride, and I was a problem child. And after all this, I never said thank you, and that's why I wrote the biography.
A real privilege, real opportunity. Anybody has any questions to pose to the Reverend? This is your big chance.
Is the book available?
Yes, actually, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it
and the title?
In a Jewish bookstore. I have a few here with me.
Oh, great. What's the title of the book?
Reverend Daphne Kaplan.
Lisa has it. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
I can say that reading the most wonderful masterpiece that Revitzin Leibowitz created, that beautiful, beautiful book, the Revitzin Misha Kaplan book. First of all, of course, we learned beautiful stories that the Revitzin just taught us about sensitivity to children's situations and just people's situations and how to handle it. That's already an amazing handbook. But the book is so beautifully written, Revitzin. You really feel, no matter how old one is, one really feels that one is being transported to another time, another country, a very important time in the history of Jewish people. And the photos are amazing. And Revitzin, thank you so much for creating that book, and thank you for being here. And I think all of you that if you are able to get that beautiful book, you will really thoroughly enjoy it. So thank you, Revitzin.
Thank you.
But it certainly is a handbook for Rebbeim, for Moras, because everything, it was no lecturing. It was every story you said was completely the opposite of what you think you're going to tell that child.
Yeah.
It was completely positivity. There was no negativity at all in any one of those approaches. And if these approaches were reused more, there would be a lot of people that would not, a lot of children, adults that would be saved from getting out to Derek or whatever, or being sad.
Well, we need more Rebbes and Kaplans, right?
Yes, we do. And like I said, it's like a handbook, and every story was like, oh my gosh, they're going to say, and then the child expected it, and because they didn't hear it, it went the other way.
It was smart, right?
And you said she had 12 children?
Actually, it was 13. But she spent her time on the school. And the children, well, the truth is, I'll tell you a little secret. She was a modern woman in her time, because she was a career woman, right? And she had a housekeeper. And her children, they told me that when her children went to the bakery, and, you know, the other kids only got rolls, our kids got chocolate bells, because, you know, they had to get something that the other kids didn't get. But they also had a lot of sandwiches for supper, and she did give up a lot for her school. Yes.
Question?
Yeah.
How old were you when you met her?
How old I was? I was the eighth grade. I was an obnoxious 13-year-old that knew it all and wanted to go to Ramaz, where it was a co-ed school with basketball and lots of fun and good time, and that's where I wanted to go. Thank God I didn't go, because I don't think I'd be standing here, nor would I have married my husband that I didn't marry. So. You all are obnoxious
12-year-olds? Yes, nothing like an obnoxious 12-year-old.
Yeah. Now you understand why she was my role model and
very moving.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. It's very good.
Very indebted, very grateful to the Reverend for giving us a free ride in a time machine.
Yes.
And I think at least I can tell you for myself personally, one thing that I think I've gleaned from listening to your words, Reverend, is the idea that, now when we study Torah, it's important to realize that there's a trickle-down effect that has a lot to do with being sensitive and caring about other people's feelings. And that's really a common denominator in many of the stories that you told. So we thank you very much. A very great book. I would like to mention that, as I met at the very outset, I pointed out that we're going into the, as far as lectures go, since we're going into the summer, we have no lectures scheduled until September. However, we do have classes. Our Jeff class on Monday night on spiritual scuba diving is taking place. You don't have to bring a towel. We provide you with a towel. And it's, you know, 8:30 Monday night. We got a phenomenal group. Many of the participants are here this evening. So call, but, you know, just to make sure we're on, if you're coming in the middle of the summer. But we have, you know, you're all very warmly welcome to join us. And we want to thank Marie and Ken for their wonderful hospitality. And Marie and Ken, we'd like to invite you all to participate in the wonderful refreshments that they have prepared. Have a safe trip home.